Hi everyone, and welcome back to Clinical Conversations, Ambulance Victoria's clinical podcast. Well, we're all familiar with the concept of STEMI. The ST segments are elevated, and that means the patient probably has a blockage in a coronary artery that needs urgent fixing, PCI or thrombolysis. But the definition is built around a single ECG sign, not the underlying problem itself. Is that the best way to do it? Should we be thinking about it in a totally different way? Is occlusive myocardial infarction, or OMI, the new STEMI? That's OMI versus STEMI in this episode of Clinical Conversations. I'm James Oswald, a paramedic and clinical guideline developer here at AV.
And I'm David Anderson, Ambulance Victoria Medical Director.
We're coming to you from the traditional lands of the Bunurong people today, and we acknowledge their elders past and present. So David, we've had a heap of feedback asking us to address this topic. So this is essentially our first episode by popular demand. Really exciting, but look, I'll be honest, love ECG interpretation, but cardiology literature is a bit of a blind spot for me. I'm not really across it in the same way that, you know, I'm across trauma literature, for example. So I'm really looking forward to learning more about OMI today.
Yeah, so am I, James. This is an area that I've been neglecting for some time, so it's been really helpful for us to be doing this episode today because it's given me the opportunity to revise my own cardiology knowledge and learn about this OMI-STEMI debate that's been going on in other parts of social media for some time. We're at the Alfred Hospital this morning in a recording studio that, despite working here for many years, I only found out existed this morning. It's very nice. And we're very lucky to be joined by Dr. Shane Nanayakara. Shane is an interventional cardiologist here at the Alfred and has very kindly agreed to have a conversation with us this morning and share some of his knowledge and his thoughts as a cardiologist in this area.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for having me. It's fantastic and what a great opportunity to speak to you both, but also to all the paramedics. I have such respect for what paramedics do, and we were just talking about that this morning. So I'm excited to have this chat and talk about cardiology.
So probably the first place to start in understanding OMI is not to look at OMI at all, but in fact to look at the idea of STEMI. To most people, including myself, ST segment elevation means coronary occlusion. It means PCI and it means thrombolysis. And no ST elevation means no coronary occlusion, no emergency PCI or thrombolysis required. It's one of those ideas that's really deeply embedded. Where did that all come from?
Well, we've gone through three phases really over time. The first thing to remember is that the heart never regenerates. So you've got heart muscle, and then the longer the blood supply is blocked, the more issues we're going to have with losing heart muscle. Because it's never going to regenerate, we need to get onto this quickly. So all we care about, forget the STEMI, the Q-wave, the OMI, whatever it is, all we care about is making sure that we know if an artery is blocked and then getting the patient to a position where we can get the artery open. And in some areas, that's going to be fibrinolysis, and in some areas, that's going to be urgent angiography and percutaneous intervention, meaning we bring them up to a cath lab, do a picture, find out where that blockage is, and open it up. And getting them to that point is the key. Now, a long time ago, let's say 50 years ago, it was all about Q waves versus non-Q waves. And over time, that progressed. And we get to this era where we've got fibrinolysis, drugs like streptokinase. And we need to figure out which patients are going to be suitable for streptokinase and who aren't. And they found that people who had ST elevation responded better to streptokinase than those who had ST depression. Now, to be fair, there are all kinds of flaws in those early trials. And part of that is how many people actually had ST depression versus ST elevation, how far were those people from therapy, how long did it take to actually give them fibrinolysis, and that all affected the results. But the point is, ST elevation was a bad thing, giving them fibrinolysis was a good thing, and nowadays we then later progress to saying ST elevation means let's open the artery in a cath lab.
So David, where are we today in terms of pre-hospital care?
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear Shane's perspective. Before I talk about where we are now, I have to share a personal little story about the first time I ever gave streptokinase as an intern. I was in the ED by myself. The consultant was on their way in. This patient was clearly having a STEMI. Gave them the streptokinase, which we don't use anymore. And one of the reasons we don't use it anymore is because it had this high association with anaphylaxis. And this patient got anaphylaxis. So I now had this old boy in front of me who was having a STEMI and anaphylaxis. And I'm the intern on my own. What a great way to learn. The patient did fine.
For what it's worth, I remember my intern story, which was I was on a surgical ward. People knew that I kind of liked cardiology as a junior doctor, and then so they'd bring an ECG and say, is this one, this issue? And someone brought an ECG that had, I think, 0.3 millimeters maybe, 0.2 millimeters of estimation. I stared at that ECG for probably all of the daughter balloon time that would have been necessary. To be honest, I was just staring for a long time. For what it's worth, this patient did not have ST elevation, but it's so fascinating how we can get so interested in this tool. And I'll highlight one of the amazing things I find about an ECG. Someone told me this very early on, is that ECG paper was relatively cheap for what value you get out of it. And now we're in the era of digital ECGs. It's not there's no expense at all. But the amount of value you get from one ECG or repeating it 5 minutes later, you're not waiting for a troponin, you just get an instant result. And it's all dependent on how we look at it, changes what happens to the patient. And I love that idea that we can do something quickly, effectively, cheaply, and change a patient's journey.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So look, where are we now in Ambulance Victoria? I hope our guideline for the management of STEMI doesn't actually differ that much from many other ambulance service guidelines across Australasia, because our guideline, which was last updated a few years ago, is based on the National Heart Foundation's guidelines. And so this is just a bit of background into how we develop guidelines. Wherever possible, we will try to either copy or modify a national standard guideline. Now, sometimes we have to modify it to suit the pre-hospital environment. But of course, STEMI in particular is one of the classic examples of a pathology that follows the journey of the patient from their home to discharge from hospital and beyond. So there are guidelines that we can follow. And so the things that we do, identifying STEMI, calling for intensive care backup, administering aspirin, which is, I think, probably the most important thing we can do, gaining IV access, administering analgesia, transmitting the ECG to your destination, administering heparin, and transporting the patient with pre-notification to a primary PCI facility, putting on defib pads, because a large percentage of these patients, or a small but significant percentage of these patients, will have a cardiac arrest during their course, particularly the anterior STEMIs. And even more so in regional, rural, and remote areas, administering thrombolysis in the patient's house with the guidance of a cardiologist. That's something that would have been unheard of, you know, even just a decade ago, but is now a standard of care. But it's all based around that initial ECG finding of STEMI, which is something that I find really interesting and something we'll go into a bit more, because an experienced paramedic can walk into the room and see the classic stereotypical pale, sweaty patient clutching their chest, looking very unwell, and have an index of suspicion that this will be a STEMI. And then on the other hand, you can walk in and see someone undistressed, texting, packing their suitcase, and the monitor says, you know, *** STEMI in capital letters. And that can generate a slightly different response. And maybe that's something we can chat about a little bit. But I guess, you know, some of the where the controversy that we might come to later on in the conversation is around the fact that we are practicing to nationally and even, you know, nationally endorsed and internationally supported guidelines, but there are these new ideas coming along about how someone might be able to enter that pathway.
So that's STEMI's origin story, I guess you could say, supervillain or superhero, depending on your perspective. But I feel like we've known for a while that ST elevation alone isn't the whole picture. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I want to highlight something that Dave said, which is think about all of those interventions that he was talking about, putting on the defib pads and giving them aspirin and getting them across to a center with PCI capability. It's amazing to think that 50 years ago, a lot of those things didn't exist. It might have been chewing aspirin. Sometimes it wasn't even that. And then they'd come to hospital and we'd do some bed rest. And then we have fibrinolytics and PCI and all of these things that we've got, defibs. It's fantastic. Talking a little bit about what those other things are, I think it became obvious as we headed into the 2000s that STEMI alone wasn't enough. So we talked about before, 70s, 80s, we're talking about this Q-wave, non-Q-wave theory. Then in the 2000s, we're kind of officially switching over. STEMI is what we're going to talk about. Let's focus on the SD segment. And then over the 20 years after the year 2000, that's when these other subtle signs came along. And now the guidelines recognize four other signs that are considered STEMI equivalents. The first is to think about posterior myocardial infarctions. And that's predominantly represented on the ECG as anterior ST depression, and anterior being V2 to V4. And then you do a posterior ECG, what's called V789, and you can Google the spots where that needs to go. And if you see 0.5 millimeters of ST elevation, then you count that as a STEMI. Why 0.5, not more than that? Because the heart's further away from the posterior wall, so you put the ECG dots on there, it's going to need less of a change to be counted as significant. Number two is something called the De Winter T waves. Now, it's hard for me to get this across in a podcast. I can make a sound that kind of sounds like a De Winter T wave. But the key thing is to look up this picture. Just Google De Winter T wave and look up what that looks like. That and Welland sign are kind of two things that I want you to Google to burn into your head. This is weird. The third are what are called hyperacute T waves. And if there's one sign I really want to impress, the paramedics are going to see this more than we do. Because by the time the ECG gets to us, it's evolved into what's called a traditional STEMI, I guess. But those really sharp, big T waves, particularly with reference to the QRS complex. You got somebody who's got a smallish QRS and this massive T wave, that's important. The proportionality between the T wave and that QRS. And the last one is what's called Scarbossa's criteria. Now that's S-G-A-R-B-O-S-S-A. Some of you might have seen it. Again, something you can Google. And there's this something called the Smith modified version of this. Basically a list of criteria that allows you to say, this person's got a left bundle branch block or some other reason that's messing up their ECG. Can I still tell if they're having a STEMI? Again, you don't have to memorize all of these things. Just be aware that there are these tricks that exist that can still represent a STEMI, even when the patient doesn't have, I guess, what we call barn door ST elevation.
The hyperacute T waves are something that make me anxious, in that I worry that I'll look at an ECG one day and miss hyperacute T waves. Do you have any advice for clinicians of an anxious disposition about what they should do if they think, oh, is this or isn't this hyperacute T waves?
It helps that I'm a clinician of an anxious disposition. So when it comes to this, I think one of the great things about an ECG is you can repeat it. So if you're not sure, I think there are probably two things. One is take into account the clinical situation. There's very rarely a patient who is completely fine, who's called the ambulance service, who has then got a surprise STEMI. Now, as you said before, there is always that person who's packing their bags and they seem fine, but they still had a symptom that you can kind of put your hat on. And that might be the classic crushing central chest pain, or it might be nausea with exertion. It varies. And keep in mind the gender biases that we have, that men and women feel myocardial infarcts differently. But take into account the clinical history, and then if you're not sure, repeat the ECG, repeat it again. Get that series, because hyperacute T waves are called that for a reason. They happen very acutely, but they progress, and so they will progress to what is called coving ST elevation. If that just means you need to do an ECG every few minutes to get that, then that's fine, because then it changes the whole patient disposition.
So now I want to bring you all to 2018. Doctors Scott Weingart, Pendle Myers, and Steve Smith pen a blog post called The OMI Manifesto. Now this shouldn't be surprising given how good a communicators these guys are, but by 2023 it's been read over 22 million times. David, what did they have to say that has drawn so much attention?
Yeah, it certainly did get a lot of attention, particularly in the emergency medicine, pre-hospital, critical care community. Look, they produced a pretty comprehensive review of the state of emergency reperfusion therapy for MI up to that point. And then they proposed a new way forward, largely based on what we've already been talking about. They went over the historical context that we've just discussed, and it is, you know, it's important for us to reflect on that. And some of our older listeners, I'm sure, will remember the Q wave days. Certainly, I started in pre-hospital care in 1997, and people were still talking about Q wave versus non-Q wave MIs. And you know, the decade before that, as Shane says, you know, 40, 50 years ago, the treatment for an MI in some cases was, I think, 6 weeks of bed rest. What could possibly go wrong? And so they speak about this transition from Q-wave MI to STEMI, and discuss the evidence, the large trials of fibrinolysis, that led to STEMI becoming a recognized thing as something that responds better to thrombolysis than other ECG changes that are associated with MI. So they certainly acknowledge that the classification or the reclassification from Q-wave and non-Q-wave to STEMI versus non-STEMI was useful, particularly because STEMI can be easily diagnosed on an ECG. But they then go on to comment that there are issues with the STEMI, non-STEMI paradigm. And in particular, the concern that they have is that ST elevation isn't as sensitive or as specific for coronary artery occlusion as many people think. Indeed, as I thought until I did some reading about this recently. It's funny how you just get carried along with what you suspect is a very good diagnostic sign. So up to a third of those with coronary artery occlusion who would benefit from urgent reperfusion don't have ST elevation. And conversely, up to a third of healthy adults, including me, have ST elevation as a normal finding on their ECG. So the authors of the manifesto, based mainly on Dr. Smith's massive collection of ECGs from many years of practice, sought to characterize ECG patterns that could be used in addition to ST elevation to help identify those needing urgent reperfusion. And Shane's already discussed some of those that have become increasingly accepted over time, in part, no doubt, because of the promotion of the OMI paradigm by Drs. Weingart, Smith, and Myers. But they then, you know, make a really interesting comment that the name STEMI may actually end up holding us back. And if we continue to talk about STEMIs and STEMI equivalents or semi-STEMIs, we may end up continuing the mindset that people have of this is either a STEMI or it's not. And so could, you know, a new name, as simple as it sounds, help with progress in this area? I would just like to add a really important caveat that there is, while these authors have now produced a lot of peer-reviewed papers in academic journals, the manifesto itself isn't peer-reviewed. It is very well referenced. It's a very comprehensive document. But this is, you know, you always need to think about, you know, especially in the current era, you know, how well supported and referenced and you know, the importance of peer review can't be understated. Although having said that, pretty much everything that they've said has now been put to that test in other forums.
I don't know if anyone else is thinking about this, but if you have ST elevation now, Dave, I feel like we should take you up to the lab. I'm actually slightly panicked for the paramedic one day who has to come up to you when you've got chest pain. And then you're like, look, the OMI criteria say that actually I'm okay. No. I think a couple of things to add in there. One thing about the OMI criteria or OMI, or I keep thinking of the cheerleader song. But anyway, the thing about this criteria is it's somewhat complicated because it's not very well defined. When I started as a cardiology registrar, one of the things you would do is the paramedics would bring in a patient. You'd see, I think it's a STEMI. Everyone goes, I think it's a STEMI. And then you go, do I call in everybody at 2:30 a.m. in the morning to do an angiogram? And please, this is not nice, but you kind of want the artery to be blocked because you're like, at least I've called everybody for the right reason. And the worst thing is when you take that first picture and you go, oh no, everything's fine. I've called it a STEMI when it wasn't a STEMI. What have I done?
But I have terrible news for you. Everything's fine.
But the key thing is that you're absolutely right. There was this study, the difficult study, that measured that 30%, about 25 to 30% of people with non-STEMIs, actually when they got their angiogram 24, 48 hours later, they had a blocked artery. And that's also bad because you go, I didn't call it a STEMI, and then they had a blocked artery. I wish I opened up their artery before that. So nailing down these subtle signs on top of STEMI is critical. So there's no doubt in my head the OMI paradigm, if you will, is the right idea to go down. But if there's one thing I've seen from us all learning STEMI, it's the idea that we need criteria. We need to know this is or isn't, and it's not always going to be perfect. And I think there are ways we can improve on it, but we've got to nail down what those are. What is a hyperacute T wave? What is the De Winter sign compared to somebody with a little bit of ST depression? There are things that I think we can capture in the gestalt. When Stephen Smith looks at an ECG or Dave looks at an ECG and they go, I know this is a STEMI. But another person goes, but why do you know that's a STEMI? That's a really important thing to try and nail down. So I think we need to get that more and more. And you know, I was watching some of these videos on what is the OMI paradigm and reading Steve's papers and going, actually, it's changing over time. With each paper, they're adding a little bit more. They're talking about terminal QRS distortion and blah, blah, blah. And genuinely, I think we're going to get to a point where there are so many subtle signs that we aren't going to be able to remember them all. And I'll come to that in a minute, but there is this idea that AI and neural networks, that is going to be the way forward. And if you look last week, I think in one of the Nature journals, Stephen Smith's published the outcomes of their AI algorithm looking at these ECGs. And it's pretty good. So maybe the ZOL ECG interpreter is going to be upgraded with something like that over time. But for now, we've got to use our clinical gestalt. Why do we talk about the OMI paradigm at all then? The reason is because we want something that enhances our clinical index of suspicion. So yes, we take a good history, but you know when you learn from someone senior, those other little things that they add in, when they say to you, oh, look, it's not always crushing chest pain, it might be nausea, you learn that for future and you update your priors so you can make a better prediction. It's going to be the same thing with an ECG. And so I'll throw you a couple of resources that are really important. Stephen Smith's blog is fantastic. There's also a gentleman called Amal Mattu, M-A-T-T-U. He's fantastic. There's the Subtle STEMI app on iOS that captures Stephen Smith's algorithm in some ways of little signs that are kind of interesting for a STEMI. There's the Ancient Scholar who does this great YouTube video series on OMI and kind of draws it all out for you so you can go into it into more detail. And then lastly, there's a guy called Elias Hanna, H-A-N-N-A. He has all of these resources, again, going through examples of ECGs. So if anyone out there is looking to do a deep dive into all of this, then there's a couple of hours you can watch over Netflix.
It's really interesting hearing about that group of patients who, you know, the coronary occlusion is identified, you know, 12, 24, 48 hours later. Because I think in my own practice as an intensivist, just leaving pre-hospital aside for a second, although it will be of interest to paramedics, is in, you know, I'll give you an example. I had a patient the other night who, using my gestalt, I looked at the ECG and thought, oh, this is a STEMI. And the cardiology registrar disagreed, which happens not infrequently. And so we just did an echo and found the regional wall motion abnormalities. Is echocardiography playing a role in any way in that group of more subtle patients in cardiology practice? Or is it still just a, you know, something that we're playing with in the ICU in the middle of the night?
Yeah, it's a fantastic tool. If ECG was the fantastic tool of the last 30 years, then echocardiography is that next exciting thing. It's not as cheap, but it's certainly getting cheaper. It's getting smaller, more portable, and it doesn't hurt anybody, almost anybody, depending on what trauma patient you have. But you know, you're putting on a probe. And if it's, again, one of those things that doesn't have an objective sign necessarily, it's never going to say to you, well, if the wall is moving by this percentage, that this is the answer. But the more you look at, like ECGs, the more experience you get, you quickly pop the probe on, and yes, it can answer a question really quickly. We've got someone who's got ST elevation but no chest pain or minimal chest pain, but they're nauseated. Do we think it's a STEMI? Let's pop the probe on and have a look. And so I'd say that if you have this ECG and you're not sure, there are probably three other things to think about. Really delve into the clinical history. Make sure that you've both looked at the patient physically, but also got that history out of, could there be any symptom related to STEMI? Second, yes, an echo probe is really useful. And the third is the serial ECG. See what changes over time. Some long-standing benign early repolarization, although benign's not the right word there, that's going to be something that will stay permanently and it's going to stay with the patient. It won't be dynamic. You're starting to see dynamic ST changes, then we know, right, we've got to do something about this occlusion. I'll add in there that there's nothing that makes the cardiology team sicker than somebody who gets the angiogram later and then you take a picture and you go, oh no, the vessel is broken. I'm sure we've all had that moment in our clinical lives where you get at that gut feeling where you go, oh no, something was missed. And so this is why we do this. The whole reason for Q-wave, STEMI, OMI, whatever it is, it's just about upskilling all of us so that we never have that moment again.
Okay, so let me ask you this. If you were trying to sell OMI, what would OMI's elevator pitch be?
We can't get heart tissue back, and we need to figure out when we're next to the patient very quickly whether their blood vessel is blocked or not. That's never going to be down to one thing. It's going to be down to 10, 20, 30, 40 things. The more of those things you know, the more you can help a patient. And so forget about worrying too much about just the STEMI criteria. Just upskill yourself the same way you would in any part of your medicine. The more you learn, the more you help people. That's why we all do it.
That's amazing. So let's flip that, and I'll ask you to play devil's advocate. OMI is not the universal paradigm right now. STEMI remains. Why is that?
Think about big problems like climate change. We want to fix climate change, but it's a big problem. And so we have to break it down into a whole set of sub-problems that have specific definitions that we can fix. A blocked blood vessel, a blocked coronary artery, has the same problem. Yes, it could be that we've got to define it as a STEMI, but we can define it in so many other ways. So the two reasons OMI hasn't come to the fore yet. One, we haven't got large, randomized, controlled trials that prove that it is superior to STEMI. Why? Because secondly, we need an objective endpoint of an algorithm that says this patient's having an OMI or not. And right now, it's a nebulous collection of concepts that are good, but they're not defined as definitely all great. I want a likelihood ratio for if they have a De Winter T wave or they have the South African flag sign or whatever it might be, I want to say this is 17 times more likely to be an MI or not. And then I want to, at the end of the day, for a patient, their simple question to you standing next to them is, am I having a heart attack? And if you say, give me 20 minutes, I'm just going to work through an algorithm and I'll be back with you. That's not what they want. They think that it is much more obviously defined. And I think what we're figuring out now is it's not so clear, but the more of these things we know, the better it is. So the next step is let's do that trial. Let's choose between STEMI or STEMI plus all of these other changes, see if we can open up more occluded arteries and prevent or save as much myocardial muscle as we can.
As a slight tangent, but something that I get asked about quite often is the importance or the relevance of the ECG sign of ST elevation in AVR associated with widespread ST depression. How does or does this fit into the OMI paradigm?
Yeah, great question. It's a bad sign, is the first thing to say. But the problem is it reflects diffuse ischemia usually of most of the myocardium. And that diffuse ischemia can happen because of coronary stenosis or because there's something else going on with the patient that's putting them under cardiac stress, or they might have a left main severe stenosis. Now, that's not quite the same as a STEMI, because if you block off your left main, you are usually not around to have an ECG and have that discussion. Every now and then there has been one, and everyone saves that angiogram and goes, look, there was one. But most of the time, it's not a STEMI, but it's still very bad. So would I treat them like a STEMI? Would I get them rapidly into a center to get them evaluated? Absolutely. But when we go down to review them in the emergency department, we're thinking about what are all those other contributors? Is it purely coronary? Is it something systemic? Is it the two of them together?
So it feels like OMI is, in short, the term for STEMI plus all of the STEMI equivalents, and it defines that combination of signs by the underlying pathology as opposed to any individual sign of that disease.
That is a great way to put it. I'm probably going to say it's three things, because I also found it hard to figure out what OMI was when I was going through the literature for this. I think it's three things. It's STEMI, it's the four STEMI equivalents we measured before, and it's a collection of additional signs that fit to make you concerned there could be a coronary occlusion. What are those additional signs? These are things like subtle ST elevation, but they have significant reciprocal changes elsewhere. Or things like the South African flag signs. Or hyperacute T waves that don't quite meet the criteria. That's in inverted commas. I did air quotes in here. I just realized. But that don't fit those traditional criteria. There are all these other little subtle things. So yes, an AI ECG interpreter might be able to capture all of these things. For now, the most important thing for people out there listening is just start to get familiar with them. Start looking up what these ECGs are. What are these things that aren't classic STEMIs, but could still represent an occluded artery that we should be treating like STEMIs?
So from a systems point of view, and wearing my guideline developer hat, I suppose, the nebulous nature of the plus in STEMI plus makes me nervous. So if people are wondering why we have a STEMI guideline instead of an OMI guideline, well, it seems like the plus in STEMI plus is not ready for prime time.
Absolutely. It's too poorly defined now, but it will be the future.
So David, naturally every paramedic is asking, sounds great, but what does it mean to me? Is it time to change? When will it be time to change? What are the next steps?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. We try to be both progressive and conservative at the same time. I think something that we need to just take a step back and realize, as we alluded to earlier, the way we treat STEMIs at the moment is, you know, to not to blow our own trumpet, is world leading. So if you have a STEMI in Victoria, or actually pretty much anywhere in Australia, you will receive better, faster treatment than pretty much someone anywhere else, or almost anywhere else in the world. So we're already treating that group very well. And there's always follow-on effects to things like this. So what that means is that because we have this very streamlined system for managing STEMI, it means people are thinking about MIs and cardiology a lot. And so when we see these more subtle ECG changes, the average paramedic, I think, will look at the ECG and say, oh, that's a bit weird. And we'll hopefully not leave the patient at home. We'll take the patient to hospital and hand that over and say to the triage nurse or the emergency doctor, look, this ECG is just not quite right. And that in itself will keep a bit of momentum up through the system. Eventually, as Shane said, if we have good evidence to guide us, I'm sure we will have a STEMI Plus or an OMI or whatever it ends up being called guideline one day. But I think we need to not be too cynical about what we already have now. I think by and large, we already have emergency department staff who trust paramedics' ECG interpretations and trust us when we think things aren't quite right, especially if we can produce, as we've already discussed, serial ECGs. So I wouldn't, I think things will change eventually. But I think in an area like this, this is something where we don't want to be standing out on our own too much. We want to be, by and large, doing the same as what national and international guidelines are suggesting. And I'm sure, the most recent update to the AHA guidelines have included the four STEMI equivalents. I think this will just continue to evolve over time.
So continuity with change. Shane, is there any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
I'm going to add in a couple of things. My research interest is artificial intelligence. So I do think that there's going to be a moment for this with ECG interpretation going into the future. So watch this space. But remember that all AI just learns by looking at lots of examples and then making a prediction. And humans can do the same thing, arguably better. So for everyone out there, spend some time and try and look at as many ECGs as you can. The more you expose yourself to, the better. And ask us, challenge us, make those questions. The second thing I'll say is that whenever you guys send a STEMI ECG to the Alfred, be aware that I have a phone that is set up to make a different ringtone just for that ECG that comes through. And so at 2:30, I have PTSD around that noise, that specific ringtone. But it's fantastic. It's such a great service that you can press a button on your machine in the field, and that's coming straight to me here at the Alfred all the way through. So it's a great system, and it's no wonder that Victoria has such a great paramedic service in terms of its response to STEMI. So I just want to say thank you so much for having me. It's been just an absolute privilege to chat to everybody out there. And if there are any questions, please ask them. We're interested.
Oh, that's awesome, Shane. We're definitely having you back on the podcast. That's been a great, we've all learned something, I think, and I hope you've all learned something as well. And I'll just make my closing remark is something that the three of us were actually talking about before we started recording. Many of you will know that I was a paramedic before I did medicine, and I think it's important to tell the paramedics listening, don't sell yourselves short. The average paramedic knows a lot more about ECGs than the average junior doctor who's not training to be a cardiologist or an emergency physician. Paramedics have a lot more didactic teaching on ECGs. I can tell you the sum total of my ECG teaching as a med student was one year two physiology lecture on what an ECG looks like. And then luckily for me, a very interested med reg during my medicine term who sat me down with her folder of ECGs. And had it not been for that, I think I'd still be, have an orthopedic level of ECG interpretation under my belt. So we are lucky as paramedics that we do get to spend a lot of time on this and have a high degree of understanding. So trust your instincts when you're looking at ECGs.
Yeah, it really has been a wonderful conversation. But before we go, a quick shout out to the medical director, its very own Hans Zimmer, our manager of clinical practice guidelines, Scott Bennett, who makes the absolutely cracking music for these podcasts. Now to our listeners, we want to hear from you, so get in touch with us on our socials, let us know what you think of today's show, if you have any questions, and really what you want the podcast to be in the future. But until then, bye for now.